For the week of August 21st, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 332, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, how are you? You seem to be on an Olympic traveling spree here. And I don't mean that you're going to the Olympics. I mean that you have not stopped traveling all summer.
Ah, well, I'm heading up to Ann Arbor, Michigan this week for a bar mitzvah. So the travels have not ended.
You know, I think that may be the first and might be the only time I ever hear I'm going to Ann Arbor for a bar mitzvah from somebody who's in Birmingham, Alabama.
That's right. But while I'm driving there, I'll be listening to the show. It's kind of like Googling yourself. You know, you listen to your own podcast. I do it every once in a while just to see how fast I'm talking and to remind myself to slow down. But when I'm listening to the show, what will I be hearing about?
Well, on this week's show, we're seeing history made at the box office, but not the good kind. NBC has had a solid Olympics in terms of ratings. The Rio Games fall smack dab in the middle of the ratings for the last six games. But did NBC and the networks abroad, did they expect more? We don't know what they promised advertisers, how many make goods they are having to pony up, how many people are watching via their DVRs, and whether all that live streaming video paid off or not. Heck, about the only thing we do know is that swimmer Ryan Lochte is a knucklehead.
And won't be wearing Speedo.
No, I don't think he's going to be wearing, I think the only thing he's going to be wearing is a tracksuit from now on.
Well, no, they just dumped him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, they dumped him as a sponsor of Ryan Lochte, yeah.
Yeah, that does not surprise me at all. He is like plutonium at this point. He's kind of, yeah. He's done. During Inside Baseball, we'll take a close look at the cable industry. We keep hearing that cord cutting is going to destroy the industry. But SNL Kagan analyst Ian Olgerson says, in fact, the outlook for the next decade looks solid. Just not for the reason you think. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our chart from ComScore. We also added information from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, LA Times, you name it. The number one movie around the world is Suicide Squad. It grossed $58 million over the weekend. It's at $570 million worldwide.
So this complete, utter Warner Brothers bomb that was, you know, just a turkey is actually doing quite
budget.
Yeah, it's doing quite well.
Yeah, so Suicide Squad tripled its budget. Obviously, you want to launch a franchise. You want the movies to be good and people excited to see the next one, not holding their noses, but they are making money. And number two around the world is The Secret Life of Pets. This one has made a lot of money. Another $50 million over the weekend, $675 million worldwide.
So what you're saying is it's no secret that The Secret Life of Pets was a big hit. Okay.
Stop. So now, when people talk about the international box office, we are adding it up and giving you the worldwide box office. But when people say the winner overseas, they said the number one movie was The Secret Life of Pets. It beat out Suicide Squad because Secret Life of Pets grossed $45 million internationally and Suicide Squad grossed $38 million internationally, that is, outside of North America. Now, why is that just really stupid? Why would you ever, you know, comparing when we list these movies, even worldwide box office, and saying this is number one, this is number two, it's a meaningless comparison, right? Because they're not all opening up worldwide at the same time. You know, Secret Life of Pets is in 54 countries, Suicide Squad is in 65. Some of them have opened in big markets, others have not only opened in a few small ones. You know, when we look at the box office in North America in a particular market, those are all movies opening in the same time in the same major country. So, yeah, some may be on four screens, but when you're looking at big, wide releases, you're comparing apples to apples. When you're looking at The Secret Life of Pets and what it grossed last week compared to Suicide Squad and what it grossed last week, that's a meaningless competition. It doesn't mean anything. That's why what really matters is waiting until the movie has played out, seeing how much it cost, and then seeing how much money it made, right?
Yeah, I mean, looking at Suicide Squad at $572 million already worldwide, okay, that's meaningful. But you're right. I mean, who knows where
Number one, number two, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's bragging rights for a week, but the reality is Secret Life of Pets may have played out of, you know, certain markets that, like North America, where that would make up a big chunk of its profits.
Yeah. So here we have, but you know, sometimes, some weeks, history is made right away, and that's certainly the case with Ben-Hur.
Yes, that was a huge movie. I loved Kirk Douglas in this movie. He was fantastic. The chariot race was amazing. You're supposed to totally interrupt me and tell me I'm talking about the wrong Ben-Hur.
Well, no, this is the Ben-Hur that made history this week, because Ben-Hur grossed $22 million over the weekend. It opened up in 24 territories, so it obviously has a number of territories to go. But everywhere it opened, it did really, really poorly. And that's history, because Ben-Hur has been box office gold every step of the way for 130 years. So well done, people. It began as a novel in 1880, massive blockbuster. It became a stage play. And no matter how many times they mounted it and toured it, that sucker made money. They made a silent film. They made a sound film. They made the Charlton Heston version.
Charlton Heston. I said Kirk Douglas, didn't I?
I thought you were making a joke.
Oh,
and
okay.
Every step of the way, it has made money. And now, finally, they've managed to make a Ben-Hur movie that looks like it's going to lose money.
Yeah. You know, as I was saying Kirk Douglas, I was like, oh, no, I just said the wrong act. Like, as I was saying it, but I just had to keep going. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. This movie looked bad from, you know, the very beginning of seeing footage from it. And as they were cutting it together, it didn't seem to be working. And then they dated it in August. It was like, oh, okay, so now we kind of know where this is going.
Well, but August doesn't have to be a dead zone. Every week and every month can have big movies in them. You just have to open up big movies. Now, it's not that big a flop, though, is it? They say the budget is $100 million, and MGM and Paramount split it up. One got, right, domestic, or maybe they split both of them. I don't know. One paid, MGM paid, I think, $80 million, and Paramount paid $20 million, or the other way around. I don't know. But nobody's in the hole for more than $80 million. That sounds like a low budget for a period epic like this, though, doesn't it?
Well, not for...
I'm just putting a question mark by the $100 million.
Yeah, I think it's probably around $100 million, but then, of course, you have your marketing budget, which can
That's a separate issue. But they're saying if they made this movie for $100 million and it flops, well, all right, but it's not $250. I don't know. I'm so jaded now. $100 million just doesn't sound like a monster gamble that you're going to be, you know, worried about your kids' college.
Well, again, this was a film made by, and I always kind of pause when trying to pronounce his name. He's a fantastic director.
So does he.
Yeah, Timur Bekmambetov.
He's a fantastic director.
Well, Wanted was good, and his Russian films are good. This one, I guess...
Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter,
okay.
Not so good.
Not so good, yes. you know, he gets a lot done for very little money.
Mm-hmm. So maybe he did that here. Certainly no big stars in it, so it is a gamble. But we have to see where it ends up, of course. It's not doing well in the countries it opened up overseas, but it grossed $22 million. You know, who knows? Maybe it'll tap out at $80 million, $100 million, $50 million. We'll find out. And then we'll know how deep in the hole they are. But again, the big hole, at least in budget terms, seems to be about $80 million for one of the two big companies that are playing. And of course, 3D screenings, they don't say a word.
No.
It was available in 3D, but not a word about how many people went to see this movie. And everyone who went to see this movie was old. Nobody under 25 went to see Ben-Hur. Like, nobody. It was amazing.
Which is like kind of who it's made for with, you know, the rippling muscles of the lead actor. And
hello. All right. At number four around the world is a movie young people did go to see. It's called War Dogs, and it stars Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. $20 million over the weekend for this sort of modern caustic look at war and mercenaries, which is based on an article from Rolling Stone. So a good solid opening weekend for a movie that cost $40 million to make. At number five is Jason Bourne, another $20 million in the till, $280 million worldwide. Whether that's a success story, we'll have to say it's not looking great, but certainly it's not going to lose anybody money. At number six, however, they are making money. It's Sausage Party, $17 million over the weekend, $70 million worldwide. Solid success. It just opened up in Australia where the Aussies love it. It's going to have a good, long, fruitful one. I wonder what the sequel will be.
I cannot believe you just said good, long, fruitful one about a movie called Sausage Party.
Yes, it's the wrong meaty sort of thing I should have said. You're right. At number seven is Pete's Dragon, which slowed down a bit here in North America. We thought it would have better legs, but it made $17 million. It's now at $60 million worldwide, which is just about what it costs to make. And number eight is Line Walker. This is the Hong Kong Chinese crime drama about hot undercover cops. $16 million over the weekend, $71 million and counting. And number nine, another movie like Jason Bourne, not a huge success story, not a huge failure either, Star Trek Beyond. It made $15 million over the weekend. It's at $230 million worldwide.
You know, you say it's not a huge failure. I look at this and go, $185 million budget. Just, you know.
Well, we're not done yet.
Okay.
We have to see where it ends up. It has quite a few territories to play out in. Internationally is where it has to make its money. The last two movies have done much better internationally. This one is only at $85 million overseas, and it's not played out yet.
Okay.
You know, it's really hard for us to know. We don't have the release schedule for the movies. We don't know, 3 months from now it's going to open in China. 4 months from now it opens in Japan. It would be great if there was some clock or ticker that we could know. All we can really do is wait like 6 months and figure, okay, all the information is in. You know, other than that, we have no way of knowing how much farther movies have to do, you know, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can look at, like, say, the BFG here and look that it's made $140 million. It's presently playing in 44 territories. It's number 21 on the worldwide list here. It's pretty much played out for the most part. And with a $70 million budget, it probably is not profitable, at least theatrically.
$140 million budget.
Pardon me. Yes, 140.
Yes, no. I was getting ready to compare it to some other recent Spielberg films that sort of made money in the same territory. Those are War Horse and Munich, but they cost half the money that the BFG costs. Yeah. So that Spielberg film again. I don't know if there's any big territory left. I don't believe there is. I think we've seen it play out in all the big territories. So there you go. Kubo and the Strings is number 10 on the charts. If we haven't confused you completely, this is an animated film. Excellent reviews. And somehow it's become the lowest grossing opening weekend for the movie from this company, Laika. I don't know how to pronounce their name. Well, they've had a string of pretty well-reviewed movies, and this one has gotten the best reviews yet. It does have a strong Japanese angle, so perhaps it'll play really well in Asia. I hope so, because, you know, make great reviews and are making animated films that are bold and different. I want them to succeed. It made $13 million on its opening weekend. That's another movie that played in 3D. And when you look at all the movies on the charts and how quiet the studios are now about 3D, one thing you'll notice, after a weekend or two, these movies that open in 3D aren't even playing in 3D, at least in my area. When I look at New York or Birmingham, Alabama, or Orlando, Florida, and I look at the listings of showtimes, you don't see any showtimes after a weekend or two for these movies. People are not going to 3D showings of these movies after opening weekend or two.
Well, I certainly see.
Once in a great while, that changes for a movie that really clicks in 3D, like Jurassic World, which is great. But I see them disappearing from the charts. Maybe that's different in LA because it's a company town.
I certainly see like Ghostbusters 5 weeks out still playing in 3D for one or two.
Not here. Not in Orlando.
Yeah.
I have to look in New York, but it's certainly not playing in Birmingham. It's playing, but it's not playing in 3D.
Well, and a part of that has to do with what screens are equipped with 3D, and if there's a new film coming out that's in 3D, they want that screen.
But like none of them are playing in 3D. Yeah, none of them. So, you know, people are not asking to see these movies in 3D 3 weeks after they've opened.
Well, any art form or any, you know, spinoff of an art form done well is always good. An art form done for pure profit and done poorly is never a good thing.
Absolutely. But I am excited to see the movie. It got great reviews. Bad Moms didn't get great reviews, but, you know, it got all right and people liked it. Another $12 million over the weekend, $100 million worldwide.
Now, I wanted to point out here, because I got this email from STX Entertainment, which is the distributor of this film, Bad Moms. And I only point this out to show you how these distributors are looking at films as they open up in different territories. They started to compare what the film is doing, Bad Moms, opposite other films, or not opposite, but in comparison to other films. So you have South Africa. They say, look, Bad Moms opened to number two with $143,000 in 65 locations, which is on par with Sex Tape at 60% and 60% ahead of Trainwreck. And in Australia, they do the same thing where they kind of compare it to Trainwreck and How to Be Single. And they're really kind of pacing themselves by looking at, you know, apples to apples, looking at, you know, how did other films of the same genre, of the same ilk do, where do they stand? And that's how this industry is working, at least on the distribution end.
Huh. That's interesting. At number 12 is Tunnel, the Korean drama about a man trapped in a tunnel. $10 million over the weekend, $37 million worldwide. And number 13 is Ghostbusters, which you can still see in 3D in Los Angeles.
Yes,
they
you can.
Wish they wish you'd go check it out. It grossed $9 million over the weekend. That's at $208 million worldwide. And number 14 is Lights Out, the horror film. Another $9 million over the weekend, $110 million worldwide. And Finding Dory, $8 million over the weekend, $915 million worldwide. This is another movie where I'd love to know what's left for it. Where can they still play it? Where can it play out? Because I don't know if there's any big territories left for that movie.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know either. But it's certainly profitable.
It certainly is. At number 16 is a new movie from Asia. It's Big Head Son and Small Head Dad, Part 2. This is a Chinese animated movie. It's based on a series that debuted in the 90s, was very popular, obviously. That got turned into a movie back in the late 90s. Now there's a new TV series in the works with more than 300 episodes planned. They're going to film them all at once, sort of the Tyler Perry idea for an animated series. So that's in the works. There's a new movie in theaters. I tried desperately to find a trailer online, but all I could find were old episodes of Big Head Son and Small Head Dad. It seems like they love each other, and their mom is always there to help them out when they get in trouble. But it grossed $7 million on its opening weekend. And number 17 is Dragons, or perhaps it's He Is a Dragon. I'm not sure what this movie is. I think this is an Asian play of a Russian fantasy film called He Is a Dragon, which got picked up earlier this year at film festivals. If that's this movie, it grossed $7 million over the weekend and is at $9 million worldwide. You know, sometimes when movies are called names like Dragon or Love, it makes it really, really hard to find out what movie it is, because that brings up Pete's Dragon, of course, and 10 million other movies just like it.
Okay, well, certainly we've gone through a long rundown of the box office for this week, which, as you say, Michael, was historic, sort of, kind of. But I wonder if it's as historic as the ratings for the 2016 Olympics in Rio will be now that they're over.
They're a disaster. A disaster.
Eh, not so much.
That's what we're saying. The coverage of this has been bizarre, to say the least. On TV in the U.S., the Summer Games in Rio is the fourth highest rated Olympic in history.
Fourth highest rated.
Fact. Fourth highest in history. Los Angeles, Atlanta, London, and now Rio.
Okay.
It's the second highest rated overseas Olympics in history. That is a fact. Everybody knows that when your own country hosts the Olympics, there's a lot more excitement and attention. That's why Los Angeles and Atlanta rate highest.
Well, wait a second. Let me ask you this. What were Atlanta and Los Angeles, what did they clock in at?
We don't know. I don't have the figures for Los Angeles. I am assuming, with all reason, that they were huge. Atlanta, I'm told they are by other people. They don't give the actual number. Atlanta in 96 scored an average of 32 million viewers during the competition.
Okay, so, you know, it's kind of hard. We talked earlier about comparing apples to apples versus apples to oranges. When you're comparing this viewership from literally different time period, literally different decades, we're talking about a 20-year span here.
Well, you know, what you know is that the Olympics remain a huge draw, and that in the 60 years since the modern era, say in the 1950s, 1952 was the first Olympics where people kind of had TVs to a degree. There have been 34 Olympics, both summer and winter. The Rio Games is the fourth highest rated Olympics in North American history. The fourth highest.
Well,
of all those 34 Olympics, it's number four.
Well, think about it this way.
And the coverage from the press has been saying, what a disaster this Olympics is. Oh, my God, NBC, they really bungled it. Oh, my God, this is a nightmare. Look how down it is from last year, which was London. Guess what? That's the third highest Olympics in history. It's the same thing we see with the box office. Last year was the highest grossing box office year in history. This year, it's not as high yet. And so everyone says, oh, my God, what a disaster. Even if this year turns out to be the second highest grossing box office year in North American history, people will say, oh, what a disaster. It's down from last year. That's just stupid. It's the fourth highest rated Olympics in history. How is that a flop?
Well, here's what the NBC executives are saying, okay? And I'm putting words in their mouth. They're saying, hey, we had an average of between 25 and 27.5 million people per night tuning in to watch. Is there any other show, any other program during prime time that's doing that for 16 straight days?
Well, 15 or 17, depending on how you count it. These averages don't include the opening and closing ceremonies.
Ah, okay.
Obviously,
well,
even bigger. But yeah, it's 15 days of competition, 17 days overall. We just got the numbers for the closing ceremony. The opening and closing ceremonies of Rio were not big draws at all compared to London. But the actual Olympics, the actual events, they did fine. They grossed over 20 million people. Of course, people watched. They just didn't watch as big numbers as they did in London. But, you know, overall, these Olympics did great. And they've got a couple new things to talk about, which is people watching live events online, watching live new events in primetime on cable, which never happened before. Nobody had to wait for a single game. If you cared about air hockey, you know, if you cared about
air hockey, that should be an Olympic sport.
If you cared about air rifle or badminton or whatever it was, you could watch it live. That's the first time that's been true in history for every single event. So there's lots of new things, and NBC's averages include either just the prime time on NBC or the extra 1.4 million people they averaged on their cable channel with live primetime programming, the first time that's been done, and the another million people they got watching live streaming during the day that they averaged out of. There are 2 billion minutes streamed in North America of Olympic Games online, and yet that only added like 1 to 2 million eyeballs in the nightly average. I'm not quite sure how that works out, but the fact is if you just look at NBC, you're looking at 24.3 million viewers. That is right in line with what you've seen in previous overseas events. Barcelona was 26 million, Seoul was 26 million, Sydney was 22 million, Athens was 24 million, Beijing was 27 million. London is the outlier, 31 million. It was a huge Olympics overseas. It was the third biggest Olympics of all time, but you're seeing mid 20 million for all those other Olympics, and that's right where Rio fell. If you add in the people who watched the cable channel primetime, and add in the people who watched online, because who cares where the eyeballs are? If they're watching, they're watching. Then you go from 24.3 million to 27.5 million. And that's how you argue that this Olympics is the third highest rated of all time.
Well, you know, what I would
I beg your pardon.
What I would say is, you know, NBC certainly cares where they're watching because the ads might be different.
Well, okay, they were charging more for the younger viewer eyeballs online.
Okay, well, you know,
more than they would for other typical online ads. They say they're fine. One thing we've heard
I'm sure they are going to
They said that the one thing we've heard is that they promised what did they promise? They promised 21 million households average, and they were only hitting 18.2 million. I don't know why or how they would promise 21 million if they're the fourth highest rated Olympics in history. which they are, or certainly the right in line with what you were doing with all the other Olympics in the last 20 years, why you would promise something dramatically higher than 18 million, I don't know.
Well,
why
especially
would you
when you're
London ratings. I don't get it.
Well, especially during a transition period where you're transitioning to another platform entirely.
They're always transitioning, right?
Well,
remember the 12 years ago when they had multicast and different cable channels showing events live. That was very exciting. It's always something new.
Yeah, although now there is, you know, there's a lot of bifurcation and kind of shattering of the attention span with people on their phones and on their tablets, and they can watch it online and on CNBC, not just NBC.
And they should make it available online. They should make it available so you can watch it if you want to live whenever you want to. A couple things. One, nobody mentions DVR usage. I keep posting comments on Hollywood Reporter and elsewhere, and one of them responded back. One of the Hollywood Reporter people said, yeah, you know, live sporting events don't get a bump from DVRs. Okay, but tell me what the actual numbers are, A, and B, primetime Olympics are not live events. They are prepackaged events that took place earlier that day. If you go on New York Times or want to know the score, you're going to find it out even accidentally. So the prime time is for people who want to sit down and watch human interest stories and a nice package thing and enjoy the Olympics. It's older people and it's women. That's who traditionally watches primetime Olympics. It's not kids. Sit down for 4.5 hours a night watching the Olympics.
Right. But I guess I would agree with that commenter from The Hollywood Reporter in that if you had, let's say, 18 million people watch live and semi-live, as you say, near live, the DVR is not going to bring it up to 30 million. It's or even, frankly, it's not going to bring it up by a million. It's going to bring it up by maybe a
why not?
10, a couple.
We see primetime TV shows get bumps of 20, 30, 40% all the time. And the Olympics is 4.5 hours of programming a night every single night.
Yeah, well,
I understand the dumbest thing one can do is extrapolate from your own personal experience. And it's true. I DVR the Olympics every day. I never sat down at 7:30 and started watching the Olympics with 800 commercials. No, I didn't. I understand the Super Bowl or the final game of the World Series, but I don't think 15 days of competition is quite the same thing, especially when it's not live and people watching it are older and women.
Yeah, I would be interested to know what the live plus three and live plus seven.
Thank you.
Well, I'd be interested to know because I think it's going to bear out what this commenter is saying.
But we've got the live plus three numbers now, and they're not mentioning them. They won't even. They're like, oh yeah, don't worry about that. Well, really? Is it 400,000 people? That would be interesting to know. If I'm wrong, tell me. But don't tell me you assume I'm wrong, because that's what they did.
Hold on. I'm making a note. Book guest to tell Michael he's wrong from Nielsen. Oh,
but we do know that these Olympics are scored right where the Olympics overseas have been scoring. We do know that if you include those people watching online and cable prime time, which is a new thing, that arguably they had 27.5 million viewers. I think that's pretty arguable. I think that's a fair metric to say, hey, whether you're watching on NBC or Bravo or NBC Sports Channel, you're watching the Olympics at that period. You know how sometimes they multicast a show on a premiere episode on three channels or five channels? You know, you add up all the eyeballs. They're all watching it, right?
Yeah, although you can't do that the sales department can't say,
of course you charge a different rate because it's only 1.4 million people watching on their cable channel.
But it might be a different advertiser entirely.
Well, I'm sure it is. Who cares? I'm not in advertising. I'm talking about how many people watched the Olympics and adding that up. Is it fair to say if you're watching on NBC and you're watching another event on Bravo in prime time at 8 o'clock and the total number of people is 27 million people, is that fair to say to add them up together?
Yes and no. Here's where I will say the yes. If you want to say how many people are watching the Olympics, yes, absolutely.
That's what I want to talk about. I'm not an advertiser. I don't care. I'm not General Mills.
But we talk about the industry on an industry level, of course.
Yeah.
You have to look at it and say, well, you know, is that advertising package the same? Does it matter?
Of course it's not the same. But we do say, well, look at NBC, how smart they are. Instead of leaving primetime blank on their cable channels because they didn't want to compete with NBC, they added an extra 1.4 million people. They added extra inventory and they sold it to advertisers at a different rate and monetized the Olympics a little bit better than if they left those channels blank.
When you spend $12.3 billion, or in this case, just for these games, $1.3 billion, you really do have to monetize, apparently.
Yes. Variety had a useful commentary. Again, they paint the Olympics as a disaster. Oh my God, the Olympics are down, even though arguably they're the fourth highest rated of all time. But putting that aside, they make some useful observations that, you know, this happens every 4 years for the Summer Olympics, or every 2 years now, since the Olympics come every 2 years. They say NBC's invested all this money. They do maybe arguably do a good job or great job with the programming during the few weeks. And of course, 6 months in advance, they start running the logo and stuff. But they say, why aren't you programming entertainment on Bravo and having athletes on the Today Show being interviewed by Matt Lauer? This should be going on for 2 years. You know, you should be having reality shows. You should be having, obviously, these events are available more and more. You can watch Big Ten gymnastics and see the Olympic athletes who are about to compete doing the same routines on the Big Ten network. You can see swimming on certain channels, but they're saying you need to really promote the Olympics 365 days a year, 4 years all round.
So instead of just saying, okay, here's the Super Bowl with two teams you may have heard of, actually play the 16 games leading up to the Super Bowl.
Well, they're all being played. Again, a lot of these swimming events and things are available now on obscure, smaller channels. They're saying beef up your reality show, beef up your coverage of them.
Right,
make
right.
use of your NBC properties like the Today Show to follow athletes 2 years out. Get people engaged because they don't have those tournaments leading up to the big finale.
Well, look, you know, even after the games are over, you know, Ryan Lochte's still being interviewed.
That's right. Did you watch his interview with Matt Lauer?
Yes, I think he over-exaggerated his redundancy.
I thought he was coached to be very legalistic and sound like a weasel.
Yeah.
You know, if he had just said, yeah, I was stupid, I behaved like an idiot, I was embarrassed, and I lied about it, and I'm ashamed of that, and I apologize to my teammates who should not have been put in that position. I certainly apologize to Rio and the people involved, and I'm just really sorry. I think that would have played a hell of a lot better for the USOC and the swimming association here in the US, which has to decide on what penalties to give him. They acted like he was in threat of being extradited and thrown into jail. That's not, that wasn't going to happen over a guy ripping a poster off a wall and maybe urinating on the side of a wall in a gas station. He wasn't going to go to jail. He wasn't going to be extradited to Rio. He needed to just say, I was a jerk and I apologize. And instead he said, well, I don't know. Was I robbed? I don't know. There was a gun. You know, it was just ridiculous.
Yeah, well.
But like you say, this was an Olympics in transition. And we did see digital news coming from all over the world, didn't we?
Well, yes. I mean, we tend to focus on at least what we have access to, which is NBC. And they, of course, paid the lion's share of the broadcast rights for North America, or I should say just for the United States. France had record digital results during the Olympics.
That's right. They had 160 million minutes streamed live. They had 20 million unique visitors to their website, FTV. Their Olympic app, of course, was downloaded, 700,000 times. I assume this sort of digital success was repeated all over the world in major countries, and that, you know, young people and millennials and people who wanted to stream the events live were doing it. So that's a really interesting development. That's going to just keep growing. I think all you're doing is satiating the super fan. You're not pulling away from prime time. You're just getting more people excited and talking about the Olympics and taking those, 10,000 hours of events and making use of them. Why hide it from people? I think they're doing the right thing.
I agree. Who knew that rugby was a sport? I'm kidding.
Is rugby in the Olympics?
It, yeah. Fiji, hello.
I didn't see that. I missed it.
Yeah. versus the All Blacks of New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
Well, we were talking a lot about ratings and scoring and how you score, which brings us to our new copywritten segment. You see how I did that? I'm copywriting our new segment. It's time for us to check out Book Filter, a book lover's best friend. How's that for a plug, Michael?
Oh, there you go.
And we're going to find out what the big book of the week is. The one book you chose out of thousands, and I mean thousands, that come out each week, and you pick this as the number one pick on your site, bookfilter.com.
That's right. Again, there are thousands of books that come out every week, so I haven't read all of them, shockingly enough. But the number one pick this week was pretty easy. It's a new novel by Caleb Carr. He's the author of The Alienist, and he has a new mystery out. So, of course, it's of interest to a lot of people. You didn't even know it was coming out, did you?
No, I didn't. And, of course, I know Caleb Carr. And when I said, hey, this new book by Caleb Carr, hey, are you surprised I know that author? And you said, no, he's a best-selling author. I'm not surprised.
He's a hugely best-selling author who really had a massive hit with The Alienist, a period mystery. The news on this book is that it's a contemporary thriller. It's about, quote-unquote, throwaway children, which is a new classification by some state governments for kids who aren't homeless, they're not orphaned, and they're not runaways, but they're simply dumped by their parents or guardians. Very nice. And it becomes caught up in this mystery, and there's a forensic specialist. But it is contemporary as opposed to a period piece, and that's a new thing for Caleb Carr. Sort of a slam dunk pick, big name author who doesn't publish a book every week. It's a new sort of area for him. It's still a mystery, but it's a contemporary one. So there's going to be a lot of interest around that. But sometimes you got to go with the obvious. But also out this week is a great debut novel about immigrants called Behold the Dreamers, a really fun nonfiction book about an animal behaviorist called Pets on the Couch. And as if he hasn't had enough bad news this week, there's a new biography of Donald Trump written by two people at The Washington Post, an editor and a writer. In other words, two losers.
Yes, this book is going to be huge. Why? Because it's
not huge.
It's going to be about me, okay?
He doesn't want it to be huge.
It's number one in the polls. It's number one in the ratings. It's number one in the lists that they keep about books that are huge.
All right.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, because I know you kind of go through all these books every week. Have you ever had to rank a book that was originally, funded through Kickstarter or got its start or beginnings on Kickstarter?
I have no idea. But I certainly wouldn't be surprised.
Well, that might be because Kickstarter has raised more than $100 million for publishing.
Right. That makes it sound like a charity event.
It's not. But I mean,
Kickstarter, different people have raised more than $100 million for projects like a novel or a nonfiction book or even doing journalism. A lot of people do it in comic books. They say, hey, I want to do this series, and they get people to fund it. I'm surprised at the staying power of this, aren't you?
Of Kickstarter?
Of getting getting fans to just say, hey, give me money so I can put out a new book or a new album.
I'm surprised, because after a while, I mean, I participated in a few Kickstarter campaigns. And, you know, when you pay the, you know, $90 for something, or the $15 or the $20, and you never actually get what it is you don't? Well, in some cases.
Oh, well, that's bad. I assume in most cases, people are paying a more modest amount and getting a book, right?
I assume
it's not just the usual, I'll call you on the phone and say thank you. I think more and more you're seeing that, hey, it's sort of like a pre-ordering thing. If enough people pre-order a copy of the book they want to create, then they get to create it. That's what I see in the publishing side. Maybe it's different for music and other areas. I don't know.
Or products like the Pebble Watch, which was a success.
Right. Well, that's a little trickier, isn't it, if you're trying to launch a new product. But in this case, in publishing, maybe it works so well because you've got an artist with a track record. And they're saying, I want to do this new project. I need this amount of money. And if you donate this level, you'll get a copy of the book when it comes out.
You know,
maybe that makes it a lot more doable.
Maybe. But now let me ask you this. Speaking of things that are doable, apparently, despite the fact that J.K. Rowling has said, no more Harry Potter, I'm done with Harry Potter, apparently she's written new books or something to that effect, because there was an announcement last week that she's like, there's ebooks that are coming out surrounding the Harry Potter world. Is this something that you're tracking? Is this something that you care about? What's going on with this?
Well, she's certainly not done with the Harry Potter world. Just like a lot of authors who create a fantasy realm or a science fiction universe, they get so invested in it and they spend so much time and energy creating it, they don't want to leave, just like the fans. Some authors get trapped in it. Others find a creative way to stay involved. And that's what J.K. Rowling has done. She's written the screenplay for a new movie. She's helped others create a stage play. So she's sort of exploring different media in the Harry Potter world, rather than just writing a new Harry Potter book or a new novel set in the past or the future. She's using that world to play in other media. And that's what she's done online with Pottermore, which is a very successful website. And on that website, she occasionally adds in new information. She'll write something about the wizarding world from the, 1400s, or, fun little stuff that fans geek out on, but are not proper novels and certainly not, stories in the sense we would think of them. However, she's done quite a bit of it. And now they said, hey, let's collect it up. And they're collecting up these anthologies of stuff she's done on the website and repackaging them so people who aren't on the website all the time or don't have the time or energy can learn some new fun little things about the world of Harry Potter. It's not a novel. It's not like a collection of short stories as such. There will be some new writing in the collections, like a story by Harry's teacher or a Slughorn, for example, or Professor Minerva McGonagall's part in the Second Wizarding War. So you will get, fun details and little brief sketches. But basically, it's sort of like repackaging material that's been available on Pottermore. Why not?
Okay, so it's not really a big deal in the publishing world then.
That's right.
Oh, well, if that's not a big deal, then I wonder whether some of our stories this week in Big Deal or Big Whoop, which is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense, I wonder if some of these stories will be a big deal. Our first story, the king is dead at Viacom. Long live the king! After a months-long struggle between CEO Philip DeMaul and the family of Sumner Redstone, DeMaul has been ousted by the board. The interim CEO is longtime executive Tom Dooley. What does this mean exactly? It means the sale of a big chunk of Paramount probably won't happen. It means Sherry Redstone's power play of refusing to endorse DeMaul ultimately paid off. And it means DeMaul will have to go off and lick his wounds, since being fired means he gets a golden parachute worth at least $72 million, and perhaps more like $90 million when all is said and done. But what's $18 million, give or take, between friends or, enemies? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? It's finally over with. Now, of course, we got to figure out what happens next. He was in charge for a decade. How did Viacom do over those 11 years? I know they're down 50% in the last 2 years, but I'm not sure how Viacom has done overall in his whole reign and how it'll be considered when all is said and done. One funny idea is that CBS could take over Viacom.
Well, there's some talk about that. We've talked about that in the past.
I can't imagine why he would want it. It doesn't. It seems like it wouldn't help CBS or Viacom particularly.
Well, it would help because CBS could help buttress Viacom while it gets back on its feet.
Yes, but why? But you're a big successful company. Why do you want to do charity work?
Right. Exactly. Well, because you're owned by the same owner. That's why.
Yeah. And his granddaughter, one of Redstone's granddaughters, has stepped in. She wants to see the deal and wants to know what's going on. So I don't think it'll create a spanner in the works. But that's happening too. That just happened today, where she stuck her nose in and said, "Hey. How much? What are you doing? What's going on?"
I heard something about a billion. What's going on here?
Yeah, it is nice to fail and get $90 million, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they wanted him out, and they were...
Well, sure, of course they did.
They signed a contract with him in 2015, and they had to know at that point that things weren't looking all that great. Should we sign a long-term contract with this guy? And so he negotiated a golden parachute, and if you want somebody out...
Your contract shouldn't be that big to begin with. But anyway, it's a different issue. It's a different socialist issue.
After years and then months and finally weeks of last-minute delays, hip-hop artist Frank Ocean finally released his new album of music and a video album with different music and a magazine. Yes, it's the new era of music where how you release an album can be just as telling as the album itself. Credit to John Carmanon. I knew I was going to stumble
Maybe
over this
Carmanonica?
Name.
Like Carmanonica?
Carmanonica? Yeah, I guess Carmanonica of the New York Times. He made the observation, Beyonce showed her steely control by surprise dropping Lemonade. Kanye West revealed his restless nature by fiddling with The Life of Pablo repeatedly, even after it was released, abolishing even the idea of a final version of his album. And now Frank Ocean used his new album, Blonde, to redefine who he is and the range of his talent from a slow movement video showing him literally building a staircase seemingly in real time to multiple versions of his album given away in pop-up stores in four major cities. So I guess his talent extends to carpentry. I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I guess guy releases album. The ghost of Karen Woodward, who is alive and well, is haunting me right now. But it's cool, and it's how you get attention. And one of the funniest things I saw was, I think it was the New York Times again, that mentioned somebody dug up a tweet from like months and months and months ago of a woman saying that she was in a bar with a guy who was boasting that he had taught Frank Ocean how to build a staircase. Turns out the guy wasn't lying because you saw him in the video literally building a staircase. So that's just one of the... I've got it. I can't wait to listen to it, but I haven't done so yet.
I wonder where the staircase goes.
Up to heaven.
Why is Univision buying Gawker for $135 million? They won the auction for Gawker. Actually, they're not buying Gawker. Univision is buying the other websites operated by the company, including Deadspin and Gizmodo and ultimately Gawker. However, they have no interest in Gawker. And as of this week, they're shutting down Gawker for good. Univision is preparing an IPO, and it already owns a number of sites beyond its core focus of serving the Hispanic and Latino communities. So Deadspin is joining The Onion and Fusion and The Root, just to name three. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a sad big deal, isn't it?
It really is.
They buy your company and they just can't even be bothered to keep it going. That is really...
Well, they're buying...
That really hurts.
They're buying the media company, which includes a number of really useful and interesting media domains.
Gawker isn't one of them.
And Gawker...
It's not worth the expense, not worth the whatever.
And frankly, the brand has been tarnished and it may not be salvageable. So they're saying, you know what? Look, it was a kind of a celebrity and, media gossip site. You turned it into a political site and it's run its course. Yeah.
Nobody else wants it. We don't want it. And it's shutting down.
Yeah. So, but,
Ouch.
Jalopnik and all of the other, Life Hacker, those are websites that are valuable and they're going to remain open. So that's kind of good news for at least the people working there.
Absolutely.
The BAFTAs are opening the floodgates. They've made a rule change that movies made available via video on demand can be eligible for award consideration. I said can, by the way, not will be. It's going to be handled on a case-by-case basis and will be the exception, not the rule. But the BAFTAs wanted to make sure they didn't ignore the best films due to some archaic rule, especially films from the international market that only played VOD in the United Kingdom. However, to avoid radically increasing the number of movies eligible for BAFTAs, they're going to decide this one at a time. Insert controversy here. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because who the hell would want to have to deal with them? You can't open it up to everything on VOD, but what a nightmare.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's just, I think what you need is like a committee to say, to grab the big high profile movies that for whatever reason are VOD, but getting great reviews and are obviously of importance, to say they have to sort of nominate it to be considered or something. Because, you know, you can't just go through all. How do they decide which ones to accept? Or, I mean, you know, you're going to go through 10 million VOD movies. Oh, what a nightmare. I appreciate the fact that they're trying to say, look, we've got some big international movies that are not getting a theatrical release. We know they're important. We'll look stupid if we ignore them. I'm interested to see how they're going to figure this out in practical, real terms.
Well, and, you know, at least, and I have to go back and look at this, but there was a rule, at least on the Academy level, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, where if you had more than 10 minutes of a movie online on an internet website of any kind, and that included streaming, that you could not, you were ineligible.
Yeah, those rules are always being adjusted and changed.
So, yeah. Well, I guess this next story could have been in the book filter section. After a shareholder meeting where Barnes & Noble touted its big plan to increase profits, essentially expand their cafes, that was their plan, the company has fired its current CEO as, quote unquote, not a good fit. We need somebody who's run a restaurant, I think is what they said. Now, the soon-to-be-retired founder, Len Reggio, is in fact not retiring, and will hang around until the company he turned into one of the biggest bookstore chains in the world can find a new leader and a new path to profitability. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, Barnes & Noble is still around, but it's in disarray. And I thought their plan for, you know, the way forward was a joke. You know, we're going to build new stores and have giant cafes and serve food and wine. It's like, well, that's not a plan for a bookstore. And it's just, it's a nightmare. I'm surprised they are still around. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm worried. If they disappear, that is really going to hurt the American book industry really badly.
I agree. Last week, we talked about a rape case surrounding the new movie Birth of a Nation.
Oh, this is just ugly and awful.
Yeah,
this whole thing.
I would have been happy just skipping this story.
I knew we would still be dealing with it, but given the news that came out, it's interesting and difficult, but you got to talk about it.
Well, Birth of a Nation won the Sundance Film Festival. The Oscar hopeful was directed, produced, co-written, and stars Nate Parker. The case resurfaced, and this is the rape case, because, of course, now Parker has a major film and the awards season spotlight on him like never before. Frankly, for the first time in his life, he's potentially a big star. It all happened when he was a wrestler, he was a wrestler at Penn State. Parker was acquitted, but the co-screenwriter of Birth of a Nation was found guilty. He appealed and got a retrial that never happened because the young woman in the case chose not to testify again. Now more details have come out about the harassment she says she received on campus, her multiple attempts of suicide at the time, and now the shocking revelation that she did in fact commit suicide a few years ago. Parker posted his reaction to the news on Facebook, while her family says they are suspicious of why this is all coming up now, won't comment further, and simply want privacy for her survivors. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, she's dead. And if you're talking about this from a industry perspective and the family not wanting to keep talking about it, that helps you move forward. Isn't that ugly and awful? But, you know, this there's not going to be some 2020 story where she gives an interview. There's not going to be, you know, this is now in his past. The fact that his co-screenwriter is really what kept this case alive, because he was acquitted. Obviously, it's an ugly part of his life and it's worth talking about. But it really has fire because the co-screenwriter was found guilty at one point and then got a retrial. So, I mean, that really, there's so many elements to the story that are difficult to deal with. Is it going to be part of every conversation and every story going forward for Birth of a Nation? They certainly hope not. He's talked about it. You know, how they deal with it, I don't know. It's ugly. It's difficult. But, you know, the fact that she is now dead somehow adds a finality to the case that allows you maybe to talk about it and deal with it and move forward, rather than if it was a new, you know, new accusations or new things would come forward about what had happened to this woman. So it's really... It was kind of shocking. I don't know. I mean, you saw, oh my God, she committed suicide in 2012. He was clearly upset. He posted a thing on Facebook, which I felt was, you know, it's always dangerous when you're posting things on your own, not waiting to have time with publicists and people. I know Karen would say, don't do that. But he said, look, don't treat this as like some sort of attempt to, you know, you know, make some bland comment. I'm just reacting as a person to this, and it's horrifying and upsetting to hear this, etc. So we'll have to see what happens with it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you asked whether, you know, this case will always be in the back of people's minds when talking about this film. I have one name for you, Ryan Lochte. What's in the back of your mind?
Well, that just happened, though, today.
True, but I
and
think...
And it's far less important.
Correct.
And it's 2 days after it happened, you know, so...
I mean, I think 10 years from now, when you hear the name Ryan Lochte, you'll kind of remember this.
Maybe, yeah. This movie's coming out in the next few weeks, though. So again, it's all fresh revelation in this. And to talk about why it came up now and the family being suspicious, and we talked about that last week. Hey, it's not just Nate Parker. There's a new sensitivity to sexual harassment and rape allegations. The fact is that the vast majority of the time, like 90 to 98% of the time, if someone says they were raped or robbed or assaulted, they were in fact raped or robbed or assaulted. So it's not just Nate Parker, because we have what happened with Upright Citizens Brigade. That's a long-running improv company, right? An improv or sketch comedy company. And they have banned comedian Aaron Glaser, or G-L-A-S-E-R, Aaron Glaser, because he was accused of sexual harassment. Now, a writer from the TV show Inside Amy Schumer, his name is Kurt Metzger, went online and kept making kind of dickish, obnoxious comments. He was really angry and pissed off. Glaser is a friend of his, and he was like, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? Someone accuses him of it. He gets railroaded out. He was very angry and upset and didn't do the best way of expressing himself by being on Twitter and Facebook and just sort of flaming people. It became a huge online thing. It blew back up onto Amy Schumer. People said, why isn't she talking out more about this? You know, she's got a new book just coming out this week about it's a collection of comic essays. And so she was on Charlie Rose having to talk about this guy. And she implied, oh, he doesn't work for me anymore. But no, he wasn't fired. The show is on hiatus, and it'll be a long time before we come back to Inside. It was a big mess.
So wait, I'm confused. Kurt Metzger was also fired due to sexual harassment?
No.
He's just a friend.
She said he doesn't work for me anymore. So stop asking me about him. And people are like, what? And then she said, well, the show doesn't exist. And they're like, what? And it turned out people are like, is Amy Schumer canceled? Is Amy Schumer gone?
No. She's just taken some time off. But yeah.
But the way she worded it, people were confused. They thought the show was done.
Oh, okay.
She made it sound like she was never going to return to the show. She's like, well, and then she said, well, no, I mean, just technically, I don't have any staff because we're on long-term hiatus. We don't have a set time to come back. And therefore, it was, you know, she made it sound like he was gone and fired, as opposed to just like, well, yeah, I still associate with him. And he's a friend and a coworker. And when we come back to the show, I assume I'll probably have him with me. But she made it sound like he was gone. And then people got confused. And then she made it sound like the show was gone. It was a headline in the Hollywood Reporter. Is Inside Amy Schumer gone? Is it over? You know, that can happen. Key and Peele did it. But it's a big, messy thing. But the takeaway is sexual harassment, allegations of rape, claims of rape, these things do not get just, oh, that sounds unpleasant, and then never discussed again. That doesn't happen anymore. I don't know what the deal is with Aaron Glaser and Upright Citizens Brigade. I assume they've been around a long time. They've got adults there making decisions with adult reasons of substantiation. There's a difference between banning someone from your sketch comedy place and throwing them in jail. He is innocent until proven guilty, but if they want to decide there is enough substantial stuff around and they don't want to have anything to do with them, you know, that's perfectly reasonable. And that's going to happen more and more.
Barbara Streisand is currently touring the United States.
That will just segue into something else. Sorry.
Well, you know, have to move on.
And rape.
Barbara Streisand is currently touring the United States, which is big news in and of itself for the stage shy performer. But in bigger news, she's taking on Apple Siri. Streisand hates it when people mispronounce her name. It's Streisand, not Streisand. And Siri gets it wrong all the time. Naturally, Babs did what any of us would do. She picked up the phone and called Apple CEO Tim Cook and asked him to fix it. Naturally, Cook did what any of us would do and said, yes, of course, Miss Streisand. Thank you, Miss Streisand. The change will appear on the September 30th update, or that actually isn't true. It's going to appear before September 30th in an update.
Oh, okay.
Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. Does it help that Tim Cook is gay? Does that play into the story at all?
I don't know. I just think it helps marketing because...
Would Bill Gates have answered her as quickly? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. I think Bill Gates would have said, what?
Yes, Ms. Streisand. Thank you, Ms. Streisand.
Right. Is Tom Cruise facing an impossible mission?
Dun, 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 dun. Sorry.
He wants a pay raise. So do I.
Da, da, da. So do I want to pay.
Yeah, exactly. Forget the raise part.
Let's take a pay.
The highly lucrative actor is about to begin filming on the sixth Mission Impossible film. One problem, he wants the studio to match the deal he's getting for starring in Universal's new franchise, The Mummy. Cruise got a sweet back-end deal from Universal, which is hoping The Mummy can kickstart an entire Universal horror movie universe. They gave Cruise the moon, maybe even the sun, in order to secure his name. Now Cruise wants the moon to star in another Mission Impossible movie, and Paramount is balking. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? They're negotiating. They'll figure it out.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to screw the pooch on his only franchise and the most profitable one of his career by far. You look at the Mission Impossible movies. They're just up now at $700 million worldwide, the last two of them. So they've bumped up to a new level, so maybe he deserves a little bit more money, but I bet he got a big back end on the last two as well. They also claim the movies only cost like $150 million.
Well, that's a lot of money to make a movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a lot anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Guess I've gotten so distorted that $150 million, I go, really? For the last two, the fourth and fifth movie in the Mission Impossible franchise? But I guess so.
$150 million, that's barely the budget of a John Hughes comedy. Yeah, no, I mean, it's $150 million is a lot of money.
And all his money comes on the back end.
Yeah, well,
right? That's $150 million without his salary.
Well, his salary is definitely some upfront money, without a doubt.
I'm sure, but you know what I mean. He ain't getting $25 million upfront. He's getting whatever in a big chunk of the back end in real first dollar participation.
Right, that's what Tom Cruise can get. Not everybody can get that. And right. what you're that's seeing here is an actor trying to maintain his or her quote.
Yes.
That's really what this is about, and it happens every day. The problem is that when your quote becomes so unachievable...
When somebody... Yeah, it's a quote on a big franchise movie. It's not a quote for everything he does, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. And Universal just took his quote and doubled it, and they're like, oh, thank you, Universal, thank you.
Yeah, and Paramount is saying, yeah, we'll give you the quote on the last payday you
had
with us.
We'd like to make some money on the movie.
Hollywood is abuzz over the new book, Powerhouse, which details the rise of CAA, the creative artist agency that likely negotiated those deals for Tom Cruise. And
it was a number one pick on Bookfilter the week it came out.
That's right. CAA under Michael Ovitz became one of the most powerful forces the movies and the entertainment industry have ever seen, eclipsing even some studios for a while. Or so it seemed. Naturally, everyone wants to find out the juicy bits from the 752-page oral history. Even more importantly, they want to know if they're in the book, okay? They want to know, where is my name? Which may explain why the manager of West Hollywood's Book Soup, a very well-known bookstore here, reports people keep coming into his store, flipping to the back, and then slamming it shut when they realize there's no index of names. I guess a lot of assistants have probably been ordered to comb through it by angry, tense bosses who don't like to read. Just like those scripts they never get around to. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. There's no index in a book. I guess the debate is whether they just didn't want to spend the money or whether they knew it would be more profitable for them not to have an index and force people to actually buy it.
Yeah, I think maybe it's, hey, this book is 752 pages. I wonder if it was more a logistical thing where it's like, oh my gosh, if we increase this anymore, think about the exponential cost of paper and binding and, you know, it starts to get really expensive.
Yeah, because it was like 10 or 12 pages, I think, of names at the beginning. I mean, it was a really long list of people who were mentioned in the book. And but I mean, these people who go into the bookstore, how cheap are they? I mean, you buy it on ebook and you search for your name. It'll take you 2 seconds.
Yeah. Listen,
I guess they
Michael.
Really didn't want to buy a copy.
Yeah, they didn't want to support the book that they were probably interviewed for.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're looking at the pay TV industry in North America, specifically cable companies. For years, we've been hearing dire warnings about cord cutting and the death of cable. And for years, we've seen stable and even increasing numbers of households pay a premium for access to hundreds of TV channels, along with broadband and the like. And the drumbeat keeps getting louder. One report said multi-channel video programming distributors, a fancy term for cable and satellite providers, have lost 700,000 subscribers in the past four quarters. They've gone from gaining a modest 1% to 2% in the subscribers to losing 1% to 2% in subscribers. A different survey saw rising numbers of subscribers fleeing pay TV, with the second quarter of 2016 seeing bigger losses than the second quarter 1 year earlier. Now, if this is all confusing, here comes a new survey by SNL Kagan. Its top analysts, Ian Olgerson and Tony Lenoir, say, in fact, the U.S. cable industry in particular looks healthy. They say it should be a stable growing business for the next decade, but don't pop the champagne cork quite yet for pay TV. They say people will slowly drift away from those massive cable bills, opting for skinny bundles and perhaps cutting the cord. But when you do, you're going to need excellent broadband service more than ever to handle all that streaming video. And guess who you'll be getting that from? That's right, your cable company. Here to discuss this is SNL Kagan analyst Ian Olgerson. Ian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ian, so I guess our first question is, the sky is not falling on pay TV subscribers, is it? There are about 90 million households who pony up money for pay TV, and they're not all going to cut the cord anytime soon, are they?
No, what we're seeing in the market is we're seeing sort of incremental declines in multi-channel subscribers. We've just gone through the second quarter results. The second quarter tends to be a seasonally soft quarter for multi-channel subscriptions. So for cable, telco, and DBS, those traditional subscriptions that people have to get their video services, they tend to move away from them a little bit in the summer months and move back in the winter months. So we've seen Q2 tends to be kind of a soft quarter, and we've seen a little bit softer than we've ever seen before in Q2. Our numbers are actually down about 823,000 on the residential side, so a little bit higher than those previous surveys that you mentioned, because we look not only at the top operators, but we survey the top about 70 or so multi-channel service providers. So we've seen a little bit larger decline in multi-channel subscriptions than we've ever seen before. And when you look year over year, it's down about 1.4 million. So you can certainly see appreciable losses. That's an annual decline of about 1.5%, but nothing that indicates indeed that the sky is falling on the industry.
And that's what you would expect in a mature industry. I mean, they've sort of maxed out on the number of people they can sign up. So you're not going to see any big long-term growth, are you?
No. And I think that when you look at maturity, what you'd expect is a plateau in subscribers that would be limited primarily by new household formation. But in this case, we're seeing not only a mature industry, but we're seeing some deterioration from people moving outside of the traditional multi-channel subscription. So there's a little bit of both of those at play here.
Well, not to get too geeky, but that kind of follows the Bass diffusion model of a product life cycle or a technology life cycle.
Correct. Certainly, we see graying in this product life cycle.
So is cord cutting then a useless term? I mean, the money may be leaving the cable industry a little bit, but people will still be paying for TV. Instead of paying their cable provider who then pays HBO, they may be paying HBO directly. It's not like most people will stop watching TV, and they certainly won't stop paying for it one way or another. They're going to have Hulu or Amazon Prime.
Well, I mean, I think that it remains to be seen exactly what happens with the absolute bill, right? The amount of spend that goes to multi-channel services or that goes to video services every month. Certainly, the current service providers and the current programmers aren't looking for ways to lower that bill in a significant way. However, as consumers sort of push a little bit on the monthly bill, we're certainly seeing some decline, potential decline there. I think that if you think about cord cutting, The idea is to sort of get away from the $85 a month average that people are spending on a multi-channel service and look to substitute with a series of perhaps smaller build a la carte services like a Netflix or a Hulu or supplementing that with an HBO Go. And ultimately, I think where consumers would like to be is someplace that's significantly south of that $80 mark. But it remains to be seen whether they're going to be able to achieve that or not.
You know, whenever I hear about these national averages, you know, whether it's movie ticket prices of, you know, $8.13 or a national average for, you know, cable subscriptions being between $80 and $85, I always wonder, where are people paying this? I'm paying like $125 a month for cable.
Well, I think that there's a couple different things that are at play there. You might be looking at a bill that includes a DVR service, and that $85 that I mentioned does not include those kinds of extra advanced services. You might be looking at a bill that has a few premium channels on there, and again, that $85. Actually, that $85 does include premium, but there's different fees that might get loaded on top of that inflate your bill a little bit.
So, are we going to start seeing these providers start to kind of nickel and dime us with everything?
They already are.
Well, good point. Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, I guess I answered my own question. They already are.
My question is, we've seen people, instead of cutting the cord or going to a skinny bundle, they seem, at least anecdotally, I hear a lot of renegotiation. Whenever you feel like, oh my God, this bill's big, you call them up and say, I'm going to cut the cord. And then they say, all right. And they lower your bill by $20 or $30. So it seems like there's been some sense of at least threat of competition is helping people lower their overall bill.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly some negotiating power there. There's also some amount of leverage that consumers have who take multiple products from an operator. So instead of buying an a la carte service, you might achieve a fairly significant discount by layering on a broadband service and even a telephone service on top of that video service. And then I think that there's also leverage that can be had in agreeing to a longer term contract. Those obviously carry with them, some problems of their own, but you can sort of lock in a price and avoid annual rate increases, or you can get a slightly better deal over a 24-month period than you might be able to achieve over a year.
Well, now, cable providers are also broadband providers, as we've stated here, but can they make up all the shortfall from lost subscribers by simply jacking up the cost of broadband?
Well, I think that if you look at absolute revenue terms, a video subscription tends to carry with it a bigger price tag, right? As I mentioned, sort of that $80 to $85 range, whereas high-speed data or broadband services tend to be in that $45 to $50 a month range. So to answer that question, if you were going to lose an equal amount of video subscribers as you gain high-speed data subscribers, you're going to end up with less absolute revenue. However, it bears mentioning that the profit margins on broadband tend to be much higher, so you end up maybe with some pressure on overall revenue, but you end up with a more profitable company that way.
Do you see any potential competition in the broadband area like we see in Europe? I mean, obviously, the rest of the developed world, we know broadband is invariably faster and cheaper because there is competition, because everybody has access to that last step into a home and they can compete with one another to be the provider. There's one general pipeline into the home and they get to say, let me be your provider. We don't have that in the U.S., and I'm assuming we've seen cable providers, that's why we have, you know, poorer service and it's more expensive because they have a sort of a monopoly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that wireline competition tends to be limited by the amount of investment required to form an alternative. So right now, most consumers have access to an option from a cable provider and a telco. And if they're lucky, that telephone provider has upgraded that system beyond sort of traditional DSL. If they're not so lucky, then they haven't. So they're really looking at a relatively slow DSL connection or your traditional cable connection. And that does put a limit on competition. I think that as we sort of look at the next 5 years, the potential impact of 5G could lessen some of that. We could also see increased investment by the telcos to move speeds up, which creates a slightly more competitive environment. But I think that when we look at the wireline segment, the prospects of adding multiple new wireline players are pretty dim.
Well, Google Fiber, certainly they found that out, and they found out just how expensive it is to lay fiber all the way to the last mile. Do you think, though, that initiatives like Google Fiber are helping push the existing broadband providers that are out there, at least in the markets where Google Fiber exists? Is that helping push them in terms of providing better service?
I think there's no question that there was sort of a shock wave created by, if nothing else, at least created by the threat of Google Fiber moving into markets. So we saw AT&T respond with its 1 gig efforts. Verizon didn't face a lot of potential overlap with Google Fiber because they already have a fiber presence. And then the cable operators have accelerated a platform that they call DOCSIS 3.1, enables them to push their platform to a one gig level in a fairly economical way. So certainly there's been an impact from Google, even though the relative influence of absolute or actual subscribers, say households that can get Google Fiber, is relatively low.
But now you mentioned something kind of in passing, which is this term 5G, which has no standard around it right now, but could potentially be not necessarily a marketing term, but actually surpass wireline speeds from what I've been reading. Is that the case? Can you explain to us how 5G fits into this equation?
Well, I mean, I think that, as you mentioned, without actual specs, it's a little difficult to speculate what the real impact will be. And we really are looking at sort of probably 2020 type of time frame. So it's fairly far out on the horizon. But the promise of being able to deliver relatively competitive wireless broadband access, at least in terms of throughput and speeds, is something that could potentially push the wireline industry. I think that some of the same kinds of scarcity issues that currently face the spectrum for 4G wireless, I don't believe that gets completely eliminated. So as households use more and more bandwidth, even though a wireless option might be able to meet some of the speed competitive marketing on the speed front, they have a difficult time maintaining the capacity to shoulder the increased usage. So I think that 5G certainly stands out there as kind of a potentially tantalizing element in the competitive dynamic going forward, but there's still a lot to be answered in terms of how much actual impact it'll have.
We're so used to hearing about just a handful of big players like Time Warner Cable. I'm a little shocked that you mentioned that you were able to survey like 70 plus different companies and to find out their subscriber churn and how they were doing in the second quarter of 2016. Are there really 70 different companies? Are there like mom and pop companies setting up broadband and cable services in the country that we don't know about?
Yeah, there's actually hundreds of smaller cable operators and telcos that provide video service.
In the Appalachian Mountains, where are they?
They're all over. You'd be shocked at how many Iowa telcos there are that provide a video service. But we do focus the majority of our attention on those top operators because they represent 90-95% of the subscribers. But that that pool that takes up the other 5% of subscribers is actually made up of lots and lots of companies.
And overall, when you're looking at the industry, you say, "Hey, look, the next decade it looks pretty stable. Their earnings should be solid. There is a change in the industry of people slipping away from the big cable bill, but they are providing broadband, and that's a better, more profitable segment of their business. And they're going to be pretty good for the next 10 years. Maybe down the road, something like 5G or a wireless competition will" put the fear of God into them, but that's not happening anytime soon. Is that sort of a good summary of what you're talking about?
I think so. I mean, I think that if you look specifically at the video front for the cable industry, their outlook is a little brighter than it has been in the past because there's been some secular shakeups in the way that the telco and DBS industries are looking at video. So the cable operators have a little bit brighter outlook in terms of their video subscriptions. However, we still think that their subscribers are going to decline. And when you put those next to sort of restrained rate hikes, you end up with small declines in video revenue over time, according to our models. However, those small declines in video revenues are more than compensated for by continued upside in broadband revenue. You've got subscriber growth. You've got revenue upside in terms of being able to charge people more year over year and move them into higher packages. And then for the cable industry, you also have this growing commercial services segment where they sell high-speed data and phone services as well, some video services to the small and medium-sized businesses. So when you couple those together, the outlook looks fairly stable for the industry.
Well, now, we couldn't let you go without asking how you access television. Is it cable? Do you have satellite? Have you cut the cord entirely, or are you hoping for a skinny bundle?
I'm what you might term a whale in the industry. I've got a cable service for both video and high-speed data, as well as a home telephone service. So I've yet to even cut the cord on phone service. And then we subscribe to multiple sort of online subscription services.
Wow, you are? Yeah, because then you'd have Netflix and Hulu. Wow, that's amazing.
So when you talk to them, they love you.
Yes.
You don't always feel the appropriate amount of love, I think, but there is some leverage there.
Well, Ian Olgerson with SNL Kagan, an analyst with SNL Kagan, thank you for taking the time to join us and to kind of tell us what your study was about and what your survey was about regarding the next 10 years in the U.S. cable industry.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that was good of Ian Olgerson to stop by with us and talk about the cable industry.
Yes, when I first reached out to him, he said, you know, I don't know that this is really the stuff of podcasts or even any casts.
He doesn't know how boring our podcast can be.
And by boring, you mean amazing.
And exciting.
And interesting.
Exactly. And
in fact, you would know that if you subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to the show. You can rate and review the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our username. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. That information.
Do you think Ian will like us on Facebook now that he's been on the show? Maybe we can increase our subscribers by having everyone on the show.
That's true. Next week, the rest of the world. Special guest. Okay, well, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to Ian's work. We'll place some links to his survey there in the show notes at showbizsandbox.com. You can also email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, we already know Michael Giltz's website, bookfilter.com, but every week he has a new and exciting website to tell us about. What is it this week, Michael?
It's IStillHeartTheOlympics.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, I don't know. Head on over to TheHuffingtonPost.com or, you know, MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.